From the heart of rural France, this is the Keto Woman podcast, brought to you by me. Hello, keto lovelies. I'm Daisy Brackenhall, and I've spent most of my life struggling with my weight and confidence, and have always had a difficult relationship with food. Even when I finally got to my target weight after weight loss surgery and eating low carb, I couldn't maintain it and I was miserable. I've been keto now for over 2 years and it has given me the freedom to fall in love with food again without the constant gain, loss, guilt, virtue cycle of before. Health and happiness is where it's at now, running on fat. Welcome to the Keto Woman podcast. Each week I'll be chatting to inspirational women, maybe even the odd man, to discover the secrets to their success so that I can share them with you. So what is keto? Keto is a way of eating that enables you to switch your body's main fuel source from sugar to fat. Who doesn't want to be a fat burner, right? But how do we achieve this? A great place to start is by keeping carbs under 20 grams a day. So things like leafy greens and above ground vegetables, plus some nuts and seeds and the incidental carbs you find in things like full fat dairy. Choose delicious fatty proteins and be free and easy with oily dressings on salad and butter on your veggies. Once you're in the swing of things, you can tweak it to suit you. Make your own personalized keto. You'll hear all sorts of ways to keto from my guests. There is no one way to do keto, no one size fits all. I hope to show you just how flexible and fabulous this way of eating can be. I'm not a doctor, and most of my guests won't be either, so we really can't give you medical advice. It's always best to consult your own doctor when making big changes to your diet and lifestyle, because they know you and your medical history, and so have access to the bigger picture. Wouldn't it be helpful to have one place where you could find all the links? Want to sign up to my new Patreon-exclusive Facebook group, Daisy's Lovelies? No problem. How about subscribing to my YouTube channel? Please help me notch up my first 1,000 subscribers by going to links.ketowomanpodcast.com and following the YouTube link. Not following me on Instagram yet? Hit the Instagram button. You get the idea. All the buttons, all the links you need are at links.ketowomanpodcast.com. Welcome to episode number 164 and the second part of my chat with extraordinary man and podcast favourite Richard Morris. Thank you so much for all your lovely messages about how much you enjoyed the first part of our chat, which if you are listening to the podcast for the first time, you might want to scroll back a week and listen to first. I'll put a handy link in the show notes, which you can find at ketowomanpodcast.com/163. And there's a link right here where you're listening in the description. This week I turned 50 with very much of a whimper rather than a bang, but I did end up spending a very nice evening FaceTiming with family and friends and then chatting with my KKBs after rather too much bubbly before I went to bed, possibly in my clothes, because the planned glass or two ended up being a few more than that. And the last time I drank any alcohol was March. I have to tell you, though, electrolytes, headache tablets, coffee and bacon and eggs got rid of that hangover in record time the next morning, so I came away from the revelry relatively unscathed. Have a fabulous weekend, and I hope you enjoy the rest of Richard and my chat. I must admit, I'm not somebody who would deny a vaccine, but I'll be very honest, it's worried me about how fast it's gone from saying we need to develop a vaccine and knowing how long vaccines take to develop with all of seemingly all of a sudden, obviously it's not all of a sudden, it's well, not even a year. Okay, we've got vaccines that we're going to start injecting into mass populations. They've been injecting it into test populations for a while. And I think people have the right to be worried about that. I don't think it's unusual to be worried about that. They and I don't be. Think, you know, again, with this kind of toxic environment that we've got a bit used to, especially as everything's become very political, is that people are very fearful to say, hey, you know, I'm a little bit worried about this vaccine. Straight away, oh, you're an anti-vaxxer, you're a conspiracy theorist. Mm-hmm. Well, no, actually, I'm just a very normal person who likes to think around these things.
Yeah.
I operate a lot on logic and I'm a bit worried about it. But what you just explained there about actually, and I don't know why it's surprising, it's not surprising at all that a lot of it comes down to money, but that makes a lot of sense that actually why this, one of the biggest reasons why this process normally takes a long time is money, is financial risk.
Yes.
And actually by removing that element, that's a big element of it.
Yes.
That's probably, would I be right in saying, that's probably one of the biggest reasons why it's been able to progress as fast as it has. That seems
yes.
like, you know, yeah.
Without a doubt.
And that's very good because that's certainly for me anyway, that relieves the bulk of that concern.
Yeah. I can spend hours telling you all the things the Trump administration did wrong in this pandemic. But this is the one thing that they absolutely, totally did correctly and should be credited with the success of that. We wouldn't have had so many vaccines. We need multiple vaccines because I've mentioned before that RNA is very delicate. It falls apart very easily. If I was experimenting with RNA, I would have to keep it at minus 80 degrees. It just won't survive.
I was going to say, is this the problem that they've been talking about the temperature it has to be stored at?
Yes.
And also every time you move it around, presumably because that temperature can fluctuate, that's the problem.
Yes.
So what then is the difference between, because I believe there are three main companies producing them that have different levels of efficacy that they're saying. I think there's 95%, 90%, and there's a, is it the company from Oxford who's down more in the sort of 70%? But that one, it doesn't have the same storage issues. So,
right.
So what's going on there? What's the difference? Why can one be stored at a, well, higher temperature and the others have to have these almost impossibly low temperatures? Because how's that going to work in a, you know, in a tiny clinic
yeah.
in back end of nowhere?
So you want the RNA to be correct when it's reproduced because you don't want antibodies against something that's in your body. You know, you don't want antibodies against something that's normally attached to the outside of your cells because all of a sudden then you get an autoimmune issue.
Mm.
So you want the RNA to survive. So one of the things that they've discovered is normally if you inject RNA into somebody, as soon as it gets to body temperature, it starts to degrade almost immediately. What they did was they wrapped this RNA in a lipid shell. This is a patented process. Each of these companies has a different patent, a different technique for doing it.
Right.
And depending on what lipids, what particular recipe of lipids that we use to make these lipid shells determines what temperature it has to be stored at.
Ah, gotcha.
To be
Makes
able to
sense.
Keep the RNA inside viable. Mm. There is lots of risk. I think there's it's reasonable for you to have concerns. Any time that you are coming into contact with an antigen, whether it be a vaccine or an actual pathogen, there's a potential that the antibodies that you make against that pathogen may also recognize something in your own body. And this is why we have autoimmune diseases. So it is a risk, but you have exactly the same risk if you come up against a coronavirus.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, that makes sense. I think that's the worry with vaccines is that you're adding a risk and maybe you're adding more of a risk.
Mm.
People are saying, well, I would rather risk getting the virus than have the vaccine.
Yeah.
They've got these scales, these mental scales in their head. And, you know, which risk is larger?
Yes.
And again, I know we're talking about the individualistic perspective here.
Yeah.
You know, let's just for a moment forget about the need for community action and just talk about the, you know, the individual risk that people are trying to balance things and work things out in their own head.
So the exact same risk that you have from your antibodies not being quite accurate, the exact same risk that you have for the vaccine, you have for the pathogen as well.
There's nothing else coming along.
No,
there's
no.
You know, like with a lot of medications, there's, you know, there's the, yes, it's supposed to be treating something and it might be or it might not be effective for that. It's all the side effects that people are worried about. And I get the impression that's the problem in people's heads. Well, what side effects, what other things are going to happen with the vaccine that aren't going to happen that are more known in a way with the virus? You're saying that's just not a case.
It's actually the other way around. So you have the identical risks between the virus and the vaccine.
Because actually that's what's being injected.
Yeah.
There's nothing else.
Yeah. So essentially if you get the vaccine, you're going to be producing spike proteins from the virus, and the antibodies that you make from those spike proteins, that's the risk. The antibodies you make for the spike proteins may interact with some other part of your body. That's where the risk is.
Right.
But here's the thing. If you got coronavirus, you have exactly the same risk because your antibodies are being made for the spike protein on the outside of that virus, and they could actually interfere, or they could be some cross reactivity with important parts of your body. So that same risk exists whether it's vaccine or virus. But here's the thing. The virus has got a lot of other risks because we know a lot of them, and because, you know, it can send your immune system over the edge. And because it's reproducing out of control and it's producing so many viruses, and you're having to make so many antibodies, and you're having to produce so much interferons to lead the killer cells in on basically guide them in on the runway to be able to take out the infected cells. Because of all of that, it's a much more complicated high-risk venture to get the virus. And there's a possibility with the virus that you won't actually produce an immune response. So, you know, if you don't get an immune response, but you do get all the bad symptoms, then, you know, you potentially have those symptoms for life. So
that's very interesting. So going back to your wanted poster analogy.
Yes.
Instead of dealing with the big bad guy with the scar on his face, all these things that happen before are basically getting you further and further away from that. You know, dealing with his younger brother who's less dangerous to actually going back and heading him off at the pass. So yeah, there are still going to be some casualties, and you might come off with a few scrapes and things, but you're far less likely to have a real big problem because you're never getting to the point where you have to deal with a big bad guy with the scar on his face.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the idea. You're just trying to stop that interaction.
You are. And because every town is they're printing wanted posters and sending them around to all the other towns in the area, the bad guy can't – there's no reservoir, no place for him to go that he won't be recognised. And that's the whole point of an immune response. So that's how we shut down viruses, you know, by producing these wanted posters. Well, you know, that's kind of what a vaccine is. We're not waiting until the guy comes to town. We're making sure that we're ready for him so that we know what he's going to look like. And the minute he pops his head up, somebody's going to go, oi, there he is. There's the guy with the scar. Get him. Pile on, you know.
That's very interesting about the casings, that lipid casing that you were talking about. Because I know in the early stages, there was a lot of sort of money riding on the people at Oxford getting there first. Because I think they already had a running start because they'd already been doing testing, am I right, along similar lines. So they kind of had a running start.
Yeah, they'd also been doing some stuff with SARS as well.
Yeah, that's right.
One of the things that happened was a lot of money went into SARS when we thought it was going to be a bigger thing than it was, and it petered out very quickly. And so a lot of these research projects were half-funded, and they literally lost their funding halfway through the project because nobody wanted a SARS vaccine because it was extinct. But they had that sort of in their back pocket. They had all that technology.
Right.
The research project that I'm most hopeful for is one out of the University of Queensland that they have. So one of the things that happens is the spike protein on the outside of the coronavirus is quite constrained. So it's sort of – it's like a spring that's been sort of coiled up and pulled together and is holding its shape only because it's been held together. When we normally cut proteins off the outside of a virus to make antibodies, it loses its shape. And so we make an antibody for its unconstrained shape, for its, you know, the spring sort of spread out. These guys in Queensland have invented a technology called a molecular clamp that's able to hold the spike in the shape that it would be when it's in the coronavirus. And so I have quite high hopes for that. They're like a couple of weeks behind these other programs for their phase three. We're going to have the option of all three in Australia, so AstraZeneca, Pfizer, and the CSL one from University of Queensland.
Yeah, which is the is it the AstraZeneca one? Is that the UK one? Whichever is the one that's coming out of the UK, which has this higher storage temperature that I think
it is the AstraZeneca one. Yeah, it's Oxford University one. Yeah,
that's right. The other thing that goes with that I think, well, I certainly feel proud that because it's coming out of Britain, but the perspective on that is that it should be non-profit until the pandemic has passed, and then presumably all bets are off. But that's kind of fair. I don't, you know, I certainly don't have an issue with that. I mean, I think that's a very good approach.
Yes. So it's the same
and I
in
think
Australia.
It's going to put pressure on the other companies who I probably think don't have the same mindset as far as profits go.
So I suspect that all of them will not make money out of this vaccine. I know that sounds strange, but because the whole thing was de-risked, you wouldn't expect them to have to make money to be able to fund the risk involved.
No, that's right.
And the other thing is that what they are doing is they're developing a patentable method for delivery.
Right, I see.
So what is unique about it is these choice of lipids.
I see. So that's what they can go on to make money from. Fair enough.
And they will make a bucket load because they'll be able to create vaccines for, you know, for the herpes virus and for Ross River and all these other things. Yeah.
And especially with this storage, temperature storage coating, that sounds very important.
So that's where somebody will make money. I think all of these companies will and deserve to make money out of this because they put a lot of work into it. They don't deserve to make the kind of income that they used to make from when they had the high risk events, the high risk process, because they were able to mitigate the whole process. They need to make less money to be able to pay for it because they had to do fewer things because the government took the risk out of it for them. So there's that. But yeah, I think that you want companies who invent to get rewarded for that so that they invent more.
Well, you've got to, otherwise there aren't enough altruistic people to run companies like that. Yeah. There has to be profit in it or they're just not going to happen. I mean, you know, that's just common sense.
That brings up an interesting topic because Bill Gates, have you seen the stuff on the internet about all of the things Bill Gates is going to put? He's invented this virus so that he can sell his vaccines so that he can put microchips in your body.
Goodness, yeah. Yeah, and it's
I think 5G's involved there at some point as well.
Plandemic, isn't it? It was all planned. It's some dastardly plan. I can't remember who was talking about it, who said, okay, let's just unpick the logic of this being. Now, look, again, actually, I'll be honest here. I'm the kind of person who is in the murky bit in the middle. Mm-hmm. I don't believe the conspiracy side, but I don't think everyone's whiter than the driven snow either.
Absolutely.
But I think it's more a case of people taking advantage of opportunities and circumstance than I do that it's some kind of massive, you know, grand scheme. I mean, honestly, the guy who provides my alternative internet source, who... Mm-hmm. Fantastic, because I have an alternative internet source that actually works, but he is full on, and when I say full on, I mean full on conspiracy theorist.
Right.
Everything in the world, everything that's ever happened boils back down to the Rothschilds. Everything.
Okay.
You name it, all of it, all of it. I keep meaning to ask him what shape he thinks the earth is. I keep meaning to ask him that as a test. But somebody was talking about, let's just unpick the logic. For the conspiracy theory to be as large as some people are making it out to be, for this all to have been some dastardly plan by this one group of incredibly wealthy white middle-aged men somewhere, so many people have to have kept their secrets.
Right.
It's inconceivable.
And could make so much money by giving up their secrets.
Yeah, it's inconceivable that actually just this one or two people are speaking the truth that everybody latches onto. It just doesn't make sense from a logical point of view. What does make sense that there are probably some little half-truths. There are some little half-truths when you think about, you know, how early patents were registered and things like that. But that really comes down to people just being very savvy about market forces, very savvy about the way things work, quite possibly having some illegal insight into how, you know, government is operating and bills that are going to be passed and what's going to be legal and what isn't.
Yeah.
I can absolutely sort of buy all of that kind of, those kind of evil machinations, people knowing things they shouldn't and just, you know, working on market
and
forces and profit and just being very smart
day.
And being able
that
to see where the money's
anyway.
Going to be. That makes sense. But the idea that it sort of all comes down to future, some grand plan with an evil Bond villain stroking his cat. Yeah. And
I don't get how it became Bill Gates. I mean, I don't like Bill Gates. I've met him twice.
He certainly seems to have been up to some shady stuff with vaccines. I mean, there's some evidence out there.
He was up to shady stuff with software.
Yeah.
I mean, he wrote and then his company wrote really shoddy software and got to their point of market dominance through monopolistic tactics.
He's a good marketer.
The government really managed to stop them
too late. And shady dealer, yeah.
Yeah, he's a kind of robber baron. But I'll give him this. He decided at one point, okay, he was the wealthiest man in the world. He was worth, you know, at the time, $60 billion. I think he's worth like $120 billion now. At the time, he said, I have no intention of dropping this task on my children. I'm not going to burden them with great wealth without having earned it. I'm going to give each of my children $5 million. That's more than most kids get, you know, but they won't have an insane amount of money and they're going to have to work for it. They're going to have to make their own life and their own living. I'm going to give away everything in my lifetime. And he's actually made a decent effort of doing that. The guy will probably go down in history. We're probably going to look back in 100 years' time and say Bill Gates was probably one of the most consequential humans on the planet this year. And it will be not because of coronavirus or putting money into a vaccine for coronavirus. It'll be because he's essentially single-handedly removing malaria from the planet. Mm. You know, and malaria kills mostly kids under five. They believe that malaria has killed more humans than any other pathogen
really?
In the history of the human species. Certainly mosquitoes, mosquito-borne pathogens have killed more humans than – mosquitoes are the most deadly animal to humans across the time of our species.
Oh, goodness. There was some awful virus one year when I was in Thailand. Yeah, it got in
– Dengue or Ross River? Or?
Yeah, it wasn't. But it was those kind of – viruses that affect your blood, and basically it started off looking like the flu. If you got treatments for the flu, it would actually speed it up and you would start bleeding, basically a little bit of a nosebleed, but it would
a hemorrhagic fever.
Yeah, and you would end up just blood coming out of your pores,
right.
And that's how people were dying. And people were dying. I mean, they lost people in my father's office from it, and that was terrifying because apart from anything else, I think you got past, it's a bit like rabies, you got past the point that there was no return.
Yes.
And so you could find out at some point you had it, and it was like, well, you're doomed. There's nothing you can do now. You're going to end up bleeding out.
Ebola's like that.
I mean, I was terrified. I mean, my father was like, when you go back, if you develop a cold, you go straight to, you know, the hospital in London, foreign diseases, and you tell them where you've been.
Yeah.
And what's going on, and you make sure that they don't think you've got the flu, that they rule this out before anything else.
Wow. Yeah.
Terrifying.
Yeah. I mean, it's remarkable that Bill Gates has just decided, you know, what's killed more humans than anything else? Malaria? Okay, I'm going to stop that.
Deal with that.
At least, put my money towards doing that. Mm. So, you know, I'll give him credit for that. And as a scientist now and working in an unfunded area, Bill and Melinda Gates probably provide at least as much funding for basic fundamental science where there's no profit motive involved than the United Nations or the NIH or CSIRO or any of these organizations that do spend effort in fundamental research. So I don't like the guy. I've met him twice and didn't like him either time I met him.
Oh, really?
And I don't like his software. I don't like how he made his money. But I do like how he's spending his money, so I do respect that.
That's quite good in a way because your bias in kind of a good way when it comes to evaluating somebody, really. Mm. You're not just going to be, oh, well, I like this guy, so everything he does must be great.
Mm.
You're more likely to look for flaws than you are to ignore them.
I was cheering the guys who threw the pie in his face. So, but I have to say, he's done a decent job with how he spent his money. So, good form.
Mm. So I thought you might be a good person to advise me on this.
Mm-hmm.
I want to ask you about Betts.
Okay.
My Snorri snuffly French bulldog.
Betts as in wages or Betts as in your
Betts
dog?
Betts as in the Snorri French bulldog, who has uncharacteristically been crazily quiet today. I keep having to look over to make sure she's still breathing because she's normally snoring really loudly. But she hasn't been very well.
Mm. Sorry to hear that.
And I suddenly realised, you know, how things sort of fall into place. Well, two things really. I wait as long as I can before I go to the vets. One, because they're very expensive. Two, because the animals hate going. And so it's just a stressful experience. And quite often you end up going and they just give them antibiotics for no reason and don't really do anything anyway. So I always try and figure it out for myself first.
Right.
But I knew she had some problems. She had some weepy eyes and she had itchy ears. And we were going to the vets anyway to start the procedure for going back to the UK. So we got stuff for that. But she's been snoring more loudly. And, you know, they checked her over. And apart from those things, it was fine. I wondered if she might have ringworm. I spotted a patch on my neck, actually. I've had ringworm before.
Yeah.
And I thought, I wonder if we both got ringworm. The vet wasn't sure about that. But anyway, we got stuff for that. But typically, just after coming back from the vets, there wasn't something quite right. She was fidgeting all the time. And she often throws up her dinner anyway. I think she eats too quickly. Mm-hmm. But she was throwing up all her meals. So she was literally losing everything she ate. And suddenly something clicked in my mind. My border terrier from years ago had pancreatitis.
Yeah.
And I took him to the vet and he wasn't bad enough to be admitted, but they put him on a low-fat diet.
Yes. They did the same with Black Dog. Black Dog had pancreatitis and after a Christmas, he was nuffling ham from the plate and, well, he was under the table sort of begging for ham and was getting lots of ham and the vets put him on a low-fat diet for most of the rest of his life, yes.
And I was deeply skeptical because obviously they like to put you on their low-fat diet. And when I looked at the ingredients, it was actually higher fat.
Very expensive.
Yeah, it was very expensive and it was higher fat than what he'd been eating from the supermarket. So it's like,
oh, wow.
Well, are you just trying to make money off me?
Yes, probably.
And so, you know, being a natural skeptic and a questioner, that's what I thought. And actually, looking back on things, I wonder if that impacted what he died of. They didn't know exactly what he died for. He started doing strange things and they said he might have a brain tumor or something. But doing some research now, it seems that, you know, it can have a devastating effect on different organs of the body. And I wonder if that set up a cascade that is what ended up killing him way too early. And it's always bothered me because he was only 8 when he had to be put down and made that decision. And maybe I should have tried that. You get the idea. You know what? You're like me with dogs. And so it tortures me.
Yeah, I had the same problem about Black Dog. Black Dog he lived quite long, but he ended up getting epilepsy. He had neurological issues. He had cancer throughout a number of organs. And he had a rapid decline towards the end. He had 6 months where he went downhill very quickly. We had him on the science diet for most of the time. And I looked at it. I mean, I suspect what happens is vets know if they put him on a particular diet that it's controlled and regular and that there's no food coming from the plate that could be.
Yeah, I get that. Mm-hmm.
Could be a problem. And I mean, dogs cannot really eat human food. I mean, dogs can't eat chocolate, can't eat onions, all these kinds of things.
Yeah.
I kind of wish I had put him on the same diet I had Blue on and that I now have Bear on, which is just raw kangaroo meat, ground kangaroo meat.
Well, this is where I was going to ask you about, because I remember you writing a great article about that and you've spoken about that and what you learned about diabetes from Blue and that. So we've got this sort of, we know keto works and we know it works well for all these things. Now, and that dogs' digestive system is quite similar to ours, isn't it? And you can test them in the same way for things like blood sugar. Yes. I know they have a much higher stomach acid for breaking things like bones down and all the rest of it. And I mean, and that's what I've done with Bex. When I started, just things clicked and I thought, it feels like she's going the same kind of way. Maybe she doesn't have such a tolerance. Mm. I know she's been having a fair amount of fat in at least a partially keto diet. They have her and Rocket anyway. Ams is a fussy madam. But they have raw beef that often has quite a lot of fat in it because it's off cuts from the supermarket.
Right.
They do have a small amount of kibble as well. And I'm wondering whether, because dogs are supposed to be good on a keto diet, yours was, wasn't it? And maybe I'm messing it up by making it more of a moderate diet by having some kibble. But anyway, the things just fell into place and I thought, right, this is the problem. So I immediately went to low fat because that was the advice I'd had before.
Yes.
And from looking on Google, and so I made a really low-fat chicken and rice, basically, and she threw that up. And I looked at, if they're really bad, they get taken in and food is withheld for a few days, but they're put on a drip.
Yes.
What's the closest I can get to that? So she's basically been on watered-down stock, a really nutrient-dense stock that I've made four times a day, and we're just adding a bit more food and a bit more food, and basically until she's not throwing up. And she seems to be fine, and she stopped fidgeting. It was clear that she couldn't get in a comfortable position, but... So what is it? Are dogs, I know that dogs are good on keto. It's been proven to be very good for treating cancer and all sorts of, is pancreatitis a bit different?
Yes.
What, how does that all work? That's what's confusing me.
So the dogs on keto, it's very difficult to get it for a dog to get into keto. Humans are unusually easy to get into keto because of our large brains and because we're quite fat.
Right.
We have a lot of subcutaneous fat. Dogs are... It's very difficult to get them into keto. There is an organization in Texas that is studying...
Keto Pet.
Yeah, Keto Pet. And they're studying rescue dogs with cancer and have quite some success.
Yeah.
So that's awesome and, you know, good form to them. They actually publish their diet, what they feed the dog, so you could actually go through that. But they have a lot of fat supplemented and they have sources of linoleic acid like seed oils and the like, if I remember rightly. So... I don't know enough about veterinary science to advise you at all. It's not my field. You know, I can take a barely educated guess. But if it was my dog, if I had Black Dog again, I would ask the vet, what are you trying to do? Are you trying to decrease the amount of fats in circulation, or are you trying to decrease the amount of pancreatic enzymes that need to be used to break down food coming in? I mean, the pancreas makes enzymes that break down proteins, so...
Yes, yeah, certainly from what I've read, because you know me, I get on Google and I ask all the questions, and it says as far as pancreatitis goes, and it seems to be a universal approach that, and I don't know if this is the same with humans or if the dogs have a slightly different approach to this, that the pancreas is responsible for making most of the enzymes that break down. Fat is the big one, and that takes more enzymes, more work. So if there's, I mean, basically it's an inflammation. It's a problem, isn't it, when you get into an itis of something?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That you're trying to decrease the workload of the pancreas. So the thing that you've got to target first is fat.
Mm.
And that all makes logical sense. I mean, is it the same for humans if they have pancreatitis? Do you have to decrease the fat?
I don't know enough about human pancreatitis. I suspect if you were to try to, most of the enzymes are for breaking down proteins. As I understand it, there are a few for fats, but I mean, the bile salts are going to emulsify the fats. They do most of the work of preparing fats for digestion across the gut.
How does that work with dogs then? Do they not?
Same way. We have very similar. Dogs are probably one of the closest animals to us in
terms
of
the
length of the lower intestine and the like.
So sort of part of my head is thinking, well, is this just based on a sort of a generations and generations of fat phobia, or is this the right thing to, and I'm, is it the right thing to do? And I'm playing it safe and going with low fat and as nutrient dense as I can, and basically trying to get her to keep the food down. But I'm just, you know, I'm just trying to dig into this and thinking long term.
Yeah.
Can she go back to sort of having more fat in a sort of keto type way, or does she need to stay on low fat? That's sort of what I'm trying to figure out. How much is myth? And
yeah, I suspect carbohydrates, because they're soluble, because they, those that you can digest, you've pretty much broken down by the time it got to the stomach anyway. They're not going to have much impact on the pancreas at all. I suspect that carbohydrates are, for lack of a better term, pancreas light. I mean, the only issue is going to be insulin secretion. So I suspect in terms of reducing pancreatitis that that might be why they put a dog on a low-carb diet. As for why they keep the dog on the low-carb diet, I think that's the issue of stability.
Or low-fat diet, rather.
Yeah, sorry, the low-fat diet. In our case, it was called the science diet. It was very expensive.
Yeah, it's very expensive.
And you had to get it from the vet.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you were told in those uncertain terms, don't dare eat, feed them anything else. So it wouldn't surprise me if once the inflammation's gone, once the pancreatitis is gone, what are they worried about? Are they worried about it reoccurring if you take them off the diet?
Well, of course, I haven't actually spoken to the vet about her.
I would talk to the vet.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of identified it. Just really don't even know that it that's what it was. It's just the
oh, really?
The things she was doing reminded me of Spike, and I got in there first. And because she now seems to be fine, yes, it is something that I'll talk to the vet when we're back there, which we won't be before long. Because if she'd have got worse, yes, obviously I'd have gone. But she's gone back the other way and she's recovering. So, you know, something I'm doing right. But I'm really thinking of sort of long term, not only for feeding her actually, but the others, whether not being too worried about raw fat as I've been in their diet, perhaps I should be a bit more worried about that. And I should be looking at lowering the fat content in their food. What was the kind of fat level? Because I know you talked about using kangaroo meat, but didn't you add some fat to that as well?
Yeah, I add about, I guess, probably about 80 mils of cream cheese to each plate for the dog. So I'm supplementing it. Also, the kangaroo is ground kangaroo meat is lean, so, you know, it doesn't have a lot of fat at all. So if it was beef, I probably wouldn't add any. If it was beef with, you know, ground beef with fat, I'd just let them have that.
So that's all that goes in, the kangaroo meat and the cream cheese. You don't give them anything else.
I wish I'd put Black Dog back on that after. I wish I'd been – so this was before I was keto, that Black Dog had pancreatitis. I kind of wish I'd challenged them after the initial problem with the vomiting and the like had stopped and he'd started to get better, to say, does he have pancreatitis now? And if not, why does he have to be on the science diet? Can I feed him raw meat? You know,
see, that's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking you're better off. And I can remember seeing a vet talking about, even if you don't give them all meat, any amount of some meat they can have is going to improve their health. Yeah. So that seems to be, to me anyway, logically, that the more nutrient dense and the better quality of the food. And to be honest, part of it why I don't just feed them meat has come down to cost as well. So I've sort of, but I'm thinking more along the lines of mixing in a sort of a low fat kibble and worrying a bit more about how much fat is going in with the meat.
I must admit, I thought he had a diagnosis of pancreatitis. If it was me, I'd be taking him to the vet. That's just me. But
I'm very leery. I'm very distrustful. But no, I definitely would have done. Even if she'd have carried on as she was for that day or two.
But the fact I she would got have, better
but
with
I turned
broth.
It. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty well a 180. She's absolutely fine now. And I'm making her come out on, well, I say I'm making her come out on walks. I have to carry her halfway. You're going to laugh at this. And I will send you a picture when I get one. I'm going to get one of those baby carriers.
A baby Bjorn. I insist on a photo.
The problem is when I'm back in the UK, I need to be hands free because the others are going to have be on the lead. Here, I just open the door and they go. Right. But Bets, because the other problem she has is that she's almost blind and almost deaf. Yeah, so she has all these things. It obviously makes it stressful to go for a walk, so she doesn't want to come. But I've discovered if I carry her halfway, she'll come back. She just doesn't want to. She doesn't want to go. But then she's happy, so she's getting a bit of exercise, which again apparently is important for the treatment. But here, I don't need them on leads. Yeah. But in the UK, they're going to have to be on hands leads, so they're going to have to be hands free. And she doesn't like walking on the lead.
She's going to have to learn
I'm going to have to get one of those one of those baby carriers with Bets. And you know, I'm not at all bothered about being that crazy, crazy woman that's got a Frenchie strapped to her chest.
I insist on photographs.
I don't mind as long as Bets is happy. I've already picked out, it's like a rainbow one. So
of
it's going
it
to be
is.
Like, everyone's going to see it. But yeah, my point really is, and I don't want people to think that I don't take my animals to the vet when they're sick, because I absolutely do. I just have a healthy disregard for various reasons about the treatment that the vets offer. But if she hadn't have got much better, but she's definitely on the, I think I really headed it off at the pass. I saw the way it was going and it reminded me of something. So I got in there before it actually became a real problem. But it's just this more long term. And I know a lot of people talk about putting their pets on keto. And so I just think it's something that's going to interest people, and knowing how much fat they eat on keto, but that actually possibly we should be a bit worried about the level of fat our dogs are having. And is that partly because of the lower amount of subcutaneous fat or whatever it is? But should we just be a little bit more a little bit more cautious about giving them fat, because it seems that potentially this is where it ends up, pancreatitis, which is not a good place to be.
Right. I don't know the answer to that.
Well, damn it.
Yes, I'm sorry. I'm going to have to go back to university to do vet science just to answer this one question, Daisy. No, I really don't know, to be honest. I do want to know the answer because I feed Bear. I don't think it's ketogenic because it's not as high fat as the mob in Texas do. And I've never tested Bear for ketones. I did test Bluebell for ketones. She did make trace amount of ketones, about the same as me, really, on the same kind of food. So, But it's such a painful thing to test a dog for ketones because you can't prick their fingers. You've got to prick their ears and they hate it.
Oh, I actually, and this is another thanks to Google, and I found out it didn't really bother them. The trick is to do, you damp it with a bit of tissue first. You do the inside of their lip.
Ah. Interesting.
And it doesn't seem to bother them.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I shall do that next time.
That's how I've always tested them, yeah. Ears. Oh, I can imagine ears. Yeah. Ouchie.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, Bluebell had to get tested 3 times a day. So that was awful.
I guess that's partly the difference, though. And I mean, that's the same, actually, with humans, about whether you're needing to use keto for therapeutic reasons or whether you're just for general health or preventative or maintenance. You don't have to worry about your level of ketosis unless you're specifically treating something that needs a high level of ketosis, right. Are you? No. So perhaps it's the same with dogs, especially, you know, if you've got, so I'm thinking about the younger dogs that are much fitter and things. I'm just thinking about that longer term preventative, but that maybe don't need to obsess about being low fat, but actually need to consider the fat content quite seriously.
Bear is really quite healthy. Bluebell wasn't because she was a type 1 diabetic.
Mm.
But the good thing was on the ketogenic diet, the amount of insulin we needed to give her was a lot less. She had the same sort of issues that type 1 diabetic kids who go keto have, same kinds of issues. So.
Mm.
Yeah, but it's – no, I don't know. I'd like to know the answer to that because I don't really understand a lot about how and why dogs or humans get pancreatitis and whether a high-fat diet – is exacerbates that, and how long they have pancreatitis, and after the inflammation has gone down, do you have to have a permanent diet change? I suspect no. I suspect that it was just a way to make a lot of money. But
and I think it's true that once they've had it, they're kind of at more risk of having it again. Yeah. And there are certain other factors, like if they tend towards being a bit overweight, which she does if I don't watch her, if they're getting older, if they're not very active. So there are all things that can lead them to be more likely. But yes, this is why I wouldn't really trust the vet. I wouldn't be able to have a conversation with a homemade diet with a vet because they're not interested. They want to sell me a vet diet. They want to sell me science diet or whatever and have me on that forever.
Exactly.
So they're just not really motivated in talking these things through. That's the problem.
Yeah, no, that's definitely true. Yeah, and we have the same problem with doctors.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
When we go to regular doctors, we have exactly the same issues. Mm. Oftentimes we're on our own. We have to make sure that we're able to tell the difference between something serious and something not serious and be willing to give over to our doctors when it is something serious and trust them.
That's right.
I mean, these are difficult things, but it's something I think that's important to do.
Well, I'm very aware of taking up your time and we've talked around all sorts of things, but before we
haven't really mentioned much keto.
We haven't mentioned much keto, no, but I don't think people will mind too much. People just, I've been getting nagged for quite a while now. When's Richard coming back on? We want to hear from Richard again. So they'll just be pleased to hear your voice.
I'm a rather odd man and it's in the title. You know, you only interview odd men.
So. Exactly. It's funny how these phrases that are so typically Brit get a confusing for, it's an endless source of amusement and interest for me, just how different words and phrases get taken differently by different people. See, to me, you know, when I said that and the odd man, it's just, well, you know, the odd man as in the occasional, but
occasional, yes.
The odd, what do you mean by odd? Am I one of your odd men? It's so I love that, and I love the way things get sort
Keep
of twisted in. Slightly but yes, I am aware of time. We've gone on off on all sorts of different tangents, but before we wrap up with a top tip, as you know we do, quick heads up there in case you've forgotten. I know people want to hear just a little bit well, as much as possible about, you know, what you're doing, what you've been up to. I did mean to ask you about all those things, but we went on talking about other things. So can you just maybe give us a quick roundup of what you've been doing? You said you graduated this year. What your plans are?
Yeah, so it was a kind of a surprise graduation. I graduated in June. I have a essentially, I did a 4-year degree in 2.5 years.
I was going to say it was fast track, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was fast track.
Did it very quickly.
And in fact, I...
How did you manage that? How could you just did more?
Well, so one of the things you can do is you can... Summer in Australia is December, January. We have a summer break. That's 2 months where you could fit in a couple of subjects.
Ah, right.
And so you can do summer subjects. So I did a few of those. I also got in with a really good team of computational chemists who I did a summer project with them first. They were doing so the summer project I did was modeling neuronal cells, modeling the norepinephrine transporter in neuronal cells. And so I was basically building a computer model of the membrane of the neuronal cell and putting the protein in it and then simulating it over 15 microseconds to at an atomic level. Mm. And it's basically like a computational microscope. It's like you can actually look at all of the atoms bouncing around and see how they bounce off each other. And
cool.
So that's also very interesting. And so then in sort of January this year, I'd finished that project. And in January, I volunteered to do work because everybody was getting worried about COVID. I was doing immunology and there was an opportunity to work with the immunology labs working on robotic PCR techniques that can sort of churn through sort of tens of thousands of PCR tests that we were building that infrastructure. Or there was the opportunity to do a model of an epithelial cell, which is the cell that SARS-CoV-2 infects. And so I decided to do the latter, which was building the epithelial cell. And that's actually about to be published. We were asked to submit a paper on the epithelial membrane, the complex epithelial membrane. It's the first time it's ever been done. And so I will have a paper to my name, which is kind of cool.
Wow. Exciting stuff.
Yeah, I think it's in like 2 weeks' time we submit. The other scientists in my lab did a lot more of the work. I did the initial stuff in January and that became – and so I was just doing this as a volunteer. I was just volunteering to work in the labs, not for any other reason. And I was just finishing off my degree. But one of the subjects that I wanted to do was cancelled at the last minute because of coronavirus. And so I approached another professor to ask if he would supervise me to do a project. And he said, yeah, I'll do it in second semester. And I said, well, I'll probably be graduated by then. Thanks anyway. And then my comp chem people who I'd done the volunteer work for said, why don't we just turn the volunteer work you've done into a subject and you'll graduate. So that's it. I kind of graduated really easy in the end. So what I'm doing now is an honors project, which is I am modeling the same kind of thing, computational chemistry. So it's basically modeling at an atomic level over a biological timescale a system so that we can actually observe it like a microscope. It's like you're watching a video of all of the atoms in the membrane and the proteins interacting. It's a very interesting technique. Of course, it uses supercomputers, and to do my epithelial membrane, I probably utilize the computing capacity of a small nation just to do that one membrane. So anyway, what I'm currently doing for my honors year is I am modeling the inner mitochondrial membrane, which is where all of the proteins are that make our energy. Mm. And I'm looking at, I found a study that basically looks at the contents of this membrane based on different diets. So I've got the baseline membrane, and this has never been done before. If I publish this membrane, it'll be the first time that anybody has published a complex model of the inner mitochondrial membrane.
Wow.
And I have also a study that I'm using that has 4 different treatments for diet. And basically what they did was this is in rat livers, they fed rats a fat-free chow diet and then supplemented with fat. And the fats were either safflower oil, which is linoleic acid, olive oil, which is oleic acid and palmitic acid. The third diet was linseed oil, which is a omega-3 long-chain fatty acid. And then the fourth one is fish oil, which is actually fish oil has a lot of saturated fat in it, but it also is a long-chain omega-3 fatty acid. So the reason for the original study was comparing omega-6, which is the safflower oil, to omega-3s. But the cool thing about this is that I can actually build models of inner mitochondrial membranes based on these different diets. So I'm actually now looking at computational microscope to actually look at how these membranes are different, to see if there is any difference in how we produce energy at a, you know, at a cellular level based on the diet that we eat.
Interesting.
It has nothing to do with the fat as energy, mm-hmm. as an energy source, but all about fat as a, like Lego blocks that we use to build our membranes.
Mm.
So that's what I'm working on now. And that honors year, if I get a first class honors, I'm guaranteed a place in a PhD program. It's kind of, I think in America they would call it summa cum laude, which is the first class honors. If I can get first class honors, then next June or July, I would enter a PhD program. I'd do that for 3.5 years.
Because that means you can skip the sort of master's bit.
Yes.
So it's effectively the same as getting a master's.
If you get first class honors.
Right, gotcha.
Yeah. Mm. If you get first class honors, you can skip the entire middle step, yeah.
Right.
It is expedited, so that... I'm kind of an unusual student, obviously for age and the like, but also my interests. And so the university has sort of – I've been able to take advantage of like summer school and the like to be able to get through this stuff. My first year, my grades weren't the best. I was sort of like a solid 60% student. And then the second year, I was a solid 75% student, and now I'm solid 85%. So,
nice.
So it's getting, I'm getting better. It took me time because I started this at 52. It took me time to get up to speed, but now I'm doing really well.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? If you've followed the kind of normal progression, your brain's just in that studying momentum.
Yeah.
You know, you go from one thing, it's a progression, isn't it? I know.
You never get out of it.
O levels, A levels, degree, you know, and so on and so forth. I know I'm showing my age now with some of those. But, you know, those cogs are all well oiled.
Mm.
And although you bring so many things coming back to being a student when you're older, you bring so many extra things. But I think the thing that people underestimate often is that it takes a while to get those sort of study cogs well oiled again, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. I needed to become well adapted to, studying. So that's kind of what I'm doing.
So pushing towards the PhD. And you know what you want to do for that, don't you?
Yeah, so I'm hoping to do some postdoc work in a lab that's working. I'm becoming like a specialist in mitochondria, which is kind of cool because there's a lot to mitochondria.
Where it all starts.
So, you know, I become a postdoc in a lab that's working on mitochondrial function and get some expertise then, and then basically start my own lab and start working on metabolic disease, which is where I really want to go.
Mm. And it's good. It sounds like, you know, you're building up a really good relationship with the university and the different networks that are going around that. Presumably that's all important as well for when you're going on to get funding and to get assistance with that. Presumably that's all really part of it and important too.
Definitely is. I mean, the honors program is actually more of an apprenticeship, and I can feel I'm becoming sharpened.
Yeah.
I guess is the best metaphor to use, but I'm becoming trained in the ways and the techniques of science. It's more once you sort of get to third year in the hard sciences, and biochemistry I'd say would be hard science. Once you get to third year, you're less learning didactic information because you can find that information just reading a book or reading some papers. What you're now doing is you're learning the techniques and the methods of applying the scientific method. You know, so it's more of a, it's almost I guess, philosophy of science kind of study. But I'm finding it very valuable. And I'm finding that the way that I critique, the way that I read technical papers has changed, and the way that I critique these things has changed. And I think that I go back sometimes and listen to some of the old podcasts, and I think, yeah, I was a bit sloppy back then. So, you know, I'm enjoying being sort of fine-tuned, I guess.
Well, but that's to be expected. I mean, I'd be more worried if you weren't.
Right, yes.
What have you been doing with all this education, Mr. Morris? If you don't look back and, you know, have a few cringy moments, that I'd be more worried if that wasn't the case, I think, actually.
Yes, no, that's true enough, yeah.
Presumably, it sounds like it takes up all your time. I can remember last time we spoke, you were going to start making videos debunking things. I forget what the first one was going to be now.
Never got around to it. Never got around to it.
I forget what the first one, I meant to go and listen to it. I forget what the first one was going to be.
I wrote a script. And
what was it? What was the first one going to be? The one that you were, the first thing you were going to pull apart?
I kind of wanted to do something about the coronavirus myth.
Yeah, but it was way before that. It was way before that. Oh, I can't remember. Yeah. I'm going to have to go back and listen and find out. Yeah. But yes, presumably it's just...
I wrote a script and I wrote slideshows. Mm.
And I know you've got all the setup. You played around with the video and the green screen behind me and all that stuff.
Yeah. Yes.
You didn't appreciate just how much time your studies were going to take up, did you?
No, they take up all my time. Interestingly, next week I'm going to the press club. So the press club in Australia, they have an address every week that's on TV, the address from the National Press Club. And normally it's a politician sometimes it's a scientist or a business leader. This week next Tuesday is the Australian of the Year, Dr. James Mwaki. And he's an ophthalmologist, I believe, who won the Australian of the Year for, he's done a lot of work in remote nations and helping poorer nations to afford eyesight care and what have you. So it's for his charitable work is essentially why he got Australian of the Year. But it's interesting because he's actually a low-carb advocate.
Oh, really?
And next week his presentation is going to be on type 2 diabetes and how it's easily controlled by diet and how we've known about this for at least a decade, probably 3 or 4 decades, and our dietetic and diabetic organisations have done nothing about it. So he is going to stick it to them.
Oh,
and so nice. I'm going to this event. I've invited my professor.
You're going to be cheering at the front.
Oh, yes, I am. Well, of course, Julie works at the press club, so that's convenient. So everyone there knows me. But the other thing is I've booked an entire table. Half the table are low-carb people and half the table are scientists from ANU. So it's going to be very interesting.
I was going to say, so presumably with everything under control, you can go back to doing things like having nice meals at the press club. Yeah, nice.
We can.
Yeah.
Yes, we can. It took a lot of hard work by the people of Victoria.
Yeah, absolutely. I've seen pictures of those, some of the events you've been to. And is the truffle thing, is that there or is that somewhere else?
That was there as well, yes, the truffle event.
Yeah.
They had a bad truffle season this year, so they didn't have the event. Of course, they couldn't with coronavirus. No. But I think the restrictions actually all come off on Wednesday. So the day that we go there, we're still limited to 6 people on a table. And I think after the restrictions, they can go back to 10 people a table. So
cool.
It's only a minor difference. We have almost no coronavirus here and we're testing the sewage. And so we know the minute that it's going to show up, you know, they test the sewage and it will appear as soon as somebody is infected.
Well, enjoy the presentation. Enjoy the meal.
Will do. Thank you.
Perhaps you could leave us with a top tip.
Yes, damn it, I had one and I forgot it.
Sounds like me.
Yes, a top tip. Let me see. I think just be kind to yourself. Don't take yourself too seriously and don't be too critical about yourself and don't listen to other people's criticisms because they don't know what the hell they're talking about. That's my top tip.
I like it. Well, it has been fabulous. It would have been even nicer had you been on my doorstep again. But
sure enough.
We'll make do with a Zoom on opposite sides of the planet.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
You look after yourself, Daisy, and thank you very much for having me on.
My pleasure. Thanks, Richard. To get the resources and links from this show, please go to ketowomanpodcast.com/episodes. Please share this podcast with as many people as possible by sharing one of my links or just taking a screenshot of an episode that you enjoyed. Reviews really help raise the profile of the podcast, which gets it in front of more people, but also helps me attract a wide variety of guests. So please take a minute to leave a review on whichever podcast app or platform you like to listen on. It doesn't go unnoticed by me, the people who regularly like, share and comment on my posts. Your support really does mean the world to me. Thank you. Are you enjoying this podcast? Help me make more episodes and videos by making a pledge at my Patreon page, patreon.com/ketowomen. Or simply hit the support button on the Keto Woman Podcast website. Don't forget to join in the fun on the Keto Woman Podcast Instagram and Facebook pages and Daisy_KetoWoman on Twitter. Are you my next extraordinary woman? Maybe you've got an idea for a show, a topic you would like to hear about. Let me know how I can tickle your earbuds by dropping me a line at daisy@ketowomanpodcast.com. Before we get to this week's end quote, I just thought I'd give you a quick update on Snuffly Snorty Pants Betts. She's been doing really well and enjoying her half-cuddle, half-walking walks. She's even been doing some running, well, jogging. She's almost back up to regular meal size now and has lost some weight, which was no bad thing. Interestingly, her snoring, which had got very loud of late, has reduced dramatically, which I think is another indicator that I was on the right track with changing her food. She's currently mostly eating low-fat, homemade chicken stock with low-fat, raw 5% beef mince. She has a little of the usual scrambled egg in the mornings, and she's also been having some of the squash I've been eating from my seemingly endless harvest. She's her usual cheery self now, and currently sprawled out in front of the fire, not snoring. So on to the end quote. This is from James Baldwin, and seems fitting, even though not meant to be COVID-related. Love takes off the masks that we fear we cannot live without, and know we cannot live within. Bye-bye, keto lovelies.